You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 140, Ezekiel chapter 24. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's a scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, did you have a good New Year?
Yeah, we did. It was relaxing, uneventful. So for me, that spells good.
Well, that's good. Yeah. Well, welcome to 2017. I am still the champion of Naked Bible. Right. So nothing has changed there. So the year
status of the league is in question.
We're actually on the 24th chapter of Ezekiel, Mike. I think this is the halfway mark, isn't it? Isn't there 48?
It is.
Okay, so
it is. But I've actually been thinking, though, what am I going to do with chapters 40 to 48? I mean, I could lump those all together since it's all about the temple and, you know, like who wants to go through and measure this, measure that. But I don't know. So we might actually be over halfway. You know, who knows? I'll have to think.
Well, at least chapter-wise, that is. At least,
yeah, chapter-wise.
You know, book-wise, we're at the halfway point, so that's good. It's I think we started Ezekiel back in the summer, wasn't it? So this one's going to take us.
After months and months of doomsday messages, you know, we finally get to chapter 24, you know, which is the siege of Jerusalem. So finally, you know, we get to this point where all this stuff Ezekiel's been talking about and saying it's coming. It's, you know, we finally get there with this episode.
It's here. All right.
Yeah. So let's just jump in. I mean, Ezekiel 24, you know, is the turning point chapter, not just because, you know, it's about the siege of Jerusalem, but when this happens, you know, and since this happens, his message after this chapter is going to change. It's not going to be doom and gloom against Jerusalem. It's going to be a mix of doom and gloom against the enemy nations, you know, the nations surrounding, you know, Israel. So they're going to get their due in a series of oracles, but it's also going to be positive. There's going to be, you know, a look forward to the future of Israel, the future of the city. And as, you know, Trey just mentioned with the last eight chapters, the future of the temple, what that means, you know, it doesn't mean we'll have to wait till we get there. But the message will change after this. This is a hinge point in the whole book. So it's been pretty rough going. Again, if you're listening to these messages, you know, if you're an Israelite sitting in Babylon, you know, hearing about how bad you are and how bad the people back home are, and you know it's true. Even those who don't want to believe it, they get a demonstration of it. And when this chapter takes place, when it comes to fruition, we're going to talk about that in this episode, you know, when this actually, how to correlate what Ezekiel's saying with the actual historical siege of Jerusalem. When the captives get word of that, and they're going to get word of it while Ezekiel is still there, obviously, it's all going to hit home. But then things are going to shift. So in this chapter, this is, you know, what we're going to be reading about, the siege of Jerusalem, and it's going to be communicated again by a parable. We've seen parables before. This one's going to be what scholars call the parable of the rusty cauldron. And that's going to occupy sort of the first half of the chapter. And then we're going to get the episode where Ezekiel's wife dies. You know, God takes her life, and how he commands Ezekiel to react and respond, which in a nutshell is don't do any of the traditional mourning stuff, is going to be used as a sign act and illustration of how it's going to be once the city collapses, you know, once the city dies, so to speak, you know, and that's going to be a message, a visualization and a message for the captives. And that's what they're going to experience. And we actually get, again, word at the end of the chapter that, hey, this is what's going on. This is what's happened. And it's still perspective, though, because it's only in chapter 33 when Ezekiel actually gets word, you know, from someone who's escaped the city, when Ezekiel and the captives actually hear in real time, you know, what happened a considerable amount of time before. But that event is going to be anticipated, that the message from that fugitive that they hear that the city is destroyed, that's going to be mentioned here in this chapter. So the messaging here, though, literarily, in terms of the way the book is arranged, it's still a hinge point. So let's jump into the first verse here. We read, in the ninth year, in the tenth month, on the tenth day of the month, the word of the Lord came to me. Son of man, write down the name of this day, this very day. The king of Babylon has laid siege to Jerusalem this very day. So we'll stop there with the first two verses. Now we get a chronology here. We get a chronological mark. And scholars have noticed a long, long time that the date itself given in these two verses actually, on the surface, creates internal contradictions for the way Ezekiel presents the chronology of events elsewhere. Now, to illustrate, sort of get us into what's going on here, I have a selection from Block, his commentary, where he notes the problem. I'm bringing this up, even though this is sort of mundane material. I'm bringing it up for a specific reason that I'll sort of camp out on for a minute or two when we're through what Block says here. But Block writes, on first sight, this literary unit seems to begin predictably enough with the word event formula followed by a date notice. But within the context of the book, the latter, that is the date notice, raises several interpretive problems. First, the formulation of the date, and in other words, that's the way it's actually written. The formulation of the date notice differs from all the other ones in the book. In other words, the wording here is different than when Ezekiel gives us dates elsewhere. In the Hebrew, it's different. Whereas elsewhere, such notices usually follow immediately after, this is Hebrew, vayahi. Vayahi is typically, and it came to pass, or some such rendering like that. Whereas elsewhere, such notices usually follow immediately right after that first term, vayahi, and then precede statements beginning with haya, which is the verb to be. This one breaks up the word event formula appearing, before another Hebrew term, lemor. Again, I'm doing this for a reason, so just hang with me here. Furthermore, whereas every other notice that omits the word for month attaches the preposition bet in directly to the ordinal number. But 24:1 doesn't do that. In Hebrew, I'll just read the verse here. It's Vayehi Devar Adonai. So, and it came to pass, the word of the Lord Eli. Okay, to me, and we're going to pick up the verb, elsewhere you supply some things here. But Vayehi Devar Adonai Eli Ba Shana. So there's our in the year. And then we have Ha Tesh'i'it. Okay, we have the ninth year, Ba Kodesh, that's the month, Ha Asiri, so in the tenth month, Be Esor, La Kodesh, Lemor. Okay, we have here the tenth day of the month. So we get all the expected, we get the year, the month, the day of the month, all that. But what Block is saying is typically that follows immediately Vayehi, and then it comes before something that the verb haya that appears. That's the way it is in all the other cases of giving a date. So why isn't it here? Why switch up the way you typically announce dates in this chapter? So he points that out and says, this is the first thing to observe. What's going to happen here is this date is going to produce internal contradictions. But we notice that the date here in this case is different. So Block's starting to angle for a resolution. The difference in the date formula here is going to be part of the solution. Second, he says, correlating this date with Ezekiel 33, 21, and 22 creates impossible chronological problems inasmuch as the time span between the commencement of Nebuchadnezzar's siege of Jerusalem and the date Ezekiel receives the report that the city has fallen is 5 days fewer than 3 years. So it's almost 3 years in between if you go with this date that he gives us here. And Block's point basically is that, look, that's unreasonably long. Now, Ezekiel 33, 21, and 22 says this. Again, this is later in the book, and it's a reference to Jerusalem falling again. Okay, it's another reference to Jerusalem's fall. It says, in the 12th year of our exile, in the 10th month, on the 5th day of the month, a fugitive from Jerusalem came to me and said, the city has been struck down. Now the hand of the Lord had been upon me the evening before the fugitive came, and he had opened my mouth by the time the man came to me in the morning. So my mouth was opened and I was no longer mute. You have to remember, you know, Ezekiel was not able to talk. This is all the way back at the beginning of the book. We're gonna mention this a little bit later. But back in chapter 3, Ezekiel was struck dumb. It was 3 or 4. And so that he could only talk when God gave him a message. After the city is destroyed and he gets this report, Ezekiel says, I could talk again, you know, whenever I wanted to. But the thing to notice here in these two verses is the day, the 12th year of our exile, 10th month, 5th day of the month. You know. So if you, Bloch's saying, if you put these dates together, you take the one here in 24:1 and then the other date in chapter 33, he's like, that's a three-year interval. It's just too long. He says, since the siege of Jerusalem is known to have lasted 18 months, and that comes from 2 Kings 25, verses 1 to 3, and Jeremiah 39, 1 and 2. Since the time of the siege is known, and it's actually given to us in the Bible, he writes, it would have taken the survivor almost 1.5 years to reach the exiles in Babylon, which by any calculation is far too long. It's just not that long of a trip. Third problem, Bloch says, is the formulation of the date notice is virtually identical to the notice in 2 Kings 25 and 25:1 and in Jeremiah 52. So he says, okay, we got three things to observe here. The date that we're given creates internal problems, but if we look at how the date's given, you know, we've got to deal with three things here. So then a little later in his commentary, he writes this. Based on these observations, these three issues, one may assume that in this instance, the editor of Ezekiel's oracles, okay, I'll just stop right there. Remember way back when we started the book of Ezekiel, I said there are going to be periodic times where we have to talk about how the book was put together. And this is, again, why I bring it up. We have, many Christians have, an unworkable picture of inspiration, that the content of the Bible just sort of dropped from heaven or was downloaded into a writer's brain. When you get into stuff like this, that view just does not work. And Bloch's going to explain why we have to think about when the book was edited, how it was put together, and why. Again, which is not a magical download, okay, into somebody's head. There's actually thinking going on. There's something intentional going on. Writers and editors. So Ezekiel himself, as he's, you know, preaching this stuff, somebody's writing it down. Maybe it's him, maybe it's somebody else. But then after he's dead, it has to get put together into a form of a book. And we talked about this at the very beginning of this study. I used Ezekiel 1:1 through 3 as an example of editorial hand, how the person to number switches. You may or may not remember that, but here we go again. The person or persons putting the book together they're making decisions. They're doing things intentionally. They're not going into trances and having the words of the text downloaded into their skull. That's just not the way this works. So back to Bloch. Based on these observations, one may assume that in this instance, the editor of Ezekiel's oracles diverged from the prophet's otherwise consistent practice of dating oracles on the basis of the exile. In other words, Ezekiel typically dates things by, you know, the time they went into exile. Continuing, and that he followed the official Jewish system of reckoning based on the king's regnal year. So Bloch is theorizing here that in this instance, this date that we have that's different than all the other ones was put here by an editor, and the editor uses a different formula, dating something by the king's regnal year instead of how Ezekiel typically does it. The former would have the terminus a quo, that's Latin for the earliest possible date, so that's a little scholar speak in Bloch's commentary here. But the former would have the earliest possible date, I'll just translate the Latin, as Nisan 597 BC, but since the accession year did not enter the calculations in the latter system, the terminus a quo, the earliest possible date, would have to have been 1 year later, in other words, 596. According to the latter system, the 10 Tebet of Zedekiah's ninth year, the day the siege began, computes to January 5th, 587, And Bloch is going to argue that this is the day the siege begins, January 5th, 587. That's the timing of, in the Israelite mind, the beginning of the day of the Lord, when all this bad stuff is going to actually happen that Ezekiel's been telling us about. Now, Bloch continues, however, this conclusion raises the question of why the system used to date the present oracle should have diverged from the standard pattern in the book. The answer is surely to be found in the precision expressed in Yahweh's command to Ezekiel in the following verse. He is to write down the name of this day, presumably reflecting the official system of dating, not Ezekiel's own idiosyncratic method, but instead this one's, you know, based on sort of the real-time regnal year of the person, you know, reigning back then, whereas Ezekiel typically based dates on the date of his own exile. So if you do that, if you make that adjustment, that you assume that an editor put this date in and the editor was using the regnal year, you know, the connecting the date with the reign of the person in charge back there, instead of all the way that all the other dates are formed, then you don't have a chronological problem. Then the problem of Ezekiel chapter 33, 21, and 22, you know, this unreasonably long distance between the siege and the fugitive, you know, coming to them, that those problems are taken care of. So I wanted to again, just throw that out, like I said a few moments ago, for this reason. You have to factor this kind of thing in to your view of inspiration. Writers make decisions. They do things intentionally. There are reasons why this or that writer or this or that editor does something, and it may conflict with something else in the book. And so critics come along and say, oh, look at this chronological problem. The Bible's full of errors. No, it's time to get a clue, dude. All right. What happens here is biblical books had more than one hand touching them. That was the process. And one editor apparently wanted to date something very specifically in a different way. And that's why we have this. And the Hebrew itself is different than all of the other date formulas. That should tell you something. Again, that should give you a clue that something else is going on here. And so, again, Bloch in his commentary discusses, you know, how to look at this, how to resolve it, so on and so forth. But I mention it here not so that we all get into biblical chronology. Trust me, I've been there, done that. It's kind of a, you know, a quagmire. But it has value, again, for illustrating a point that I could say this on a podcast. I could go to a church or whatever and say, hey, you know, we need to think differently about inspiration. But here's an actual concrete example where if you're thinking that all this is just downloaded into somebody's head and that no other hands touch it, in other words, if you're thinking the biblical books don't get made like books did, normal books did, then you're going to have problems. So again, we need to let the actual, I'll do my scholar speak here now, the actual realia of the text, in other words, the phenomena, probably better to say, of the text, what's actually in the text itself, that needs to steer our theology about the text. Okay, we don't invent our theology and then ignore the text, although that's kind of what happens a lot when people do systematic theology or they talk in theory about inspiration. No, if we're going to say this thing is inspired, we actually have to look at what is actually in the thing and then formulate our doctrine on that basis. So, okay, end of little theological diatribe here. So let's go back to the chapter 24. Now, after that, after he's given the date, God gives him a command. In verse 3, it starts, so I'm going to read verses 3 to let's see, how far do we want to go? Let's go to verses 3 to 14. All right, so he's going to command Ezekiel something specific. He says, utter a parable to the rebellious house and say to them, thus says the Lord God, set on the pot, set it on, pour in water also, put in it the pieces of meat, all the good pieces, the thigh and the shoulder, fill it with choice bones. Take the choicest one of the flock, pile the logs under it, that is the pot, boil it well, seethe also its bones in it. Verse 6, therefore thus says the Lord God, woe to the bloody city, to the pot whose corrosion is in it, and whose corrosion has not gone out of it. Take out of it piece after piece without making any choice. For the blood she has shed is in her midst. She put it on the bare rock. She did not pour it out on the ground to cover it with dust, to rouse my wrath, to take vengeance. I have set on the bare rock the blood she has shed, that it may not be covered. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, woe to the bloody city, I will make the pile great. Heap on the logs, kindle the fire, boil the meat well, mix in the pieces, and let the bones be burned up. Then set it empty on the coals, that it may become hot, and its copper may burn, that its uncleanness may be melted in it, its corrosion consumed. She has wearied herself with toil. Its abundant corrosion does not go out of it, into the fire with its corrosion. On account of your unclean lewdness, because I would have cleansed you, and you were not cleansed from your uncleanness, you shall not be cleansed any more, till I have satisfied my fury upon you. I am the Lord. I have spoken. It shall come to pass. I will do it. I will not go back. I will not spare. I will not relent. According to your ways and your deeds, you will be judged, declares the Lord God. So we get this parable, and there are parts of it that are going to be clearer than others. If you went through the Leviticus series, there's this part about you didn't cover the blood on, you know, with dirt and all that stuff. That might bring your memory back to something in Leviticus we did. But just generally, we have an allegory here, and probably, I mean, well, you know, the odds are, let's just put it that way, that Ezekiel actually does this. You know, he takes a pot, he builds a fire under it, he throws the meat. You know, I mean, this may also be a sign act against. He might also be acting it out. You know, the parable as he's giving it, and then as he's giving it, its implications. So that the pot is Jerusalem. We learn that from verse 6. You know, therefore, thus says the Lord God, woe to the bloody city, to the pot whose corrosion is in it. So that the pot that has something, there's something corrosive here, or there's some kind of corruption about it. Or is it the corruption of the contents? We'll get to that in a moment. But the pot is Jerusalem. Now, you would think, again, if the pot is Jerusalem, then what's inside the pot is the thing that is corrosive or corrupt. But a lot of commentators go the other direction. So does the meat in the pot symbolize the corruption, or is it the pot itself? You know, there's a question there for interpreters. Now, the reason why there's a difference of opinion, and you'll actually get this difference kind of illustrated in translations, is that for instance, the Septuagint translator takes the Hebrew here, the word that's in the ESV translated corrosion. It's the Hebrew term tel'ah. Okay, the Septuagint translator took the Hebrew there as meaning rust. And so if you have a translator working on a particular English translation and he gets influenced by the Septuagint, the way the Septuagint handles this, then it's going to work out in the English translation that you're going to read what the translator produces and think, oh, there's something wrong with the pot. You know, the pot is rusty or something like that. And some English translations have that. The problem, though, is that verse 11 tells us the pot was made of copper, and copper does not rust. So we have kind of a real world problem, you know, with that particular angle, that particular translation. Now, that raises the question, well, you know, if it doesn't make a whole lot of sense that the, you know, the tel'ah, either translated corrosion or rust or corruption or something like that, if it doesn't refer to the pot, then you would think that it has to refer to what's in the pot. And then the question comes up, well, why in verses, you know, 4 and 5, then does God say, put in the pieces of meat, the good pieces, you know, the choice bone? You know, it sounds like there's nothing wrong with what's put in. Well, the point, I think, and again, I think you can already tell, I don't, you know, follow the Septuagint here. I don't think it makes sense to have the pot have the problem, you know, be the corrosion, because it is copper. It doesn't make any sense. I think it is the contents that are corrupt, and that matches much better the analogy of the allegory, because, okay, you could say, yes, Jerusalem is corrupt. Okay, I get that. But it's the people inside that are the problem. They're the ones who are morally accountable, you know, and Jerusalem's corruption, you know, is an abstract. It, you know, there's nothing wrong with the buildings or the streets or whatever. You know, it's the people in it that have created the problem, that have created the circumstance of the exile and God's judgment. So to me, saying the contents are corrupt makes a lot more sense in the analogy. And the reason why they'd be called the choicest and the good pieces is because they're God's people. I mean, he had chosen them from among all the nations. And, you know, they started out well, okay, would be the point. You had all these advantages. You were chosen by God. God led you into the land. And, you know, you had David and you had Solomon and you had the temple and everything was going okay. And, you know, under Solomon's reign, it starts to go a little bit sour. And then after he dies, just, you know, boy, we just know what happens. You know, the whole system just collapses. So I think that would be the point of the positive language about what's going into the pot and having the contents of the pot still be corrupted. So to me, that just makes a lot better sense. Now, Block has a comment here. He says, this statement, if you again go with the contents, represents a direct challenge to the people's mistaken perception of their status. Far from being Yahweh's choice cuts, the residents of Jerusalem are nothing more than putrid flesh, fit only to be discarded as refuse, unquote. And we've seen that this kind of messaging in Ezekiel prior to this point, where the people think a certain way about themselves. Oh, you know, we're left here. We're, you know, God's favor is upon us. You know, we're the good guys. And Ezekiel's had to say, no. That would be a mistaken conclusion to draw. And the magnitude of the mistaken conclusion is going to be illustrated for you, because the people who are left back in Jerusalem that are saying this about themselves, or that you're presuming, hey, if God left them back, we're sitting here in Babylon, but the ones that God left that didn't take into exile, they must be okay. And, you know, the city must be doing fine and be fine. And, you know, Ezekiel's saying, well, the misguided nature that is going to be shown to you pretty radically when the city is destroyed. So what Block says here, and again, I'm, you know, my own sort of trajectory here, not following the Septuagint, and obviously this isn't unique with me. But I think internally it just makes better sense to see the contents of the pot as corrupt, because it just fits the analogy better. The people inside are the ones that are going to be judged. And it's something Ezekiel has hit on many, many times. Now let's go to verse 15. Let me make a content. This blood has been shed in her midst. She put it on the bare rock. She did not pour it out in the ground and cover it with dust. I made this comment about, you know, Leviticus. So if you remember back in Leviticus, some of the regulations, again, Ezekiel's a priest, so it's kind of natural for him to take either the illegitimate blood shed, you know, that resulted from the corruption of the people, you know, inside the city. And again, he's talked about that elsewhere, you know, recently in recent episodes, we've covered that ground. It might be a reference to illegitimate sacrifice, whether it's child sacrifice or some other sacrifice. But if you remember, Leviticus has, you know, some rules about, you know, not, you know, consuming blood and disposing of blood in certain ways. And there was this notion of you wanted to cover the blood with dirt or dispose of it in a certain way so that it couldn't be reused in a ritual sense, in a wrong way, like by someone who wanted to, you know, reuse the blood, you know, to perhaps worship a different deity or to do something magical with it. Again, if you listen to the series on Ezekiel, that probably rings the bell. But since Ezekiel's a priest, he's drawing on that idea here. And it points to illegitimate worship again. So it's not just violence, random violence, even though, as we've, you know, tracked through the last few chapters of Ezekiel, there's certainly plenty of that going on in the city, plenty of that kind of human-to-human corruption and injustice. But here we have another reference, you know, to the illegitimate worship that's going on there too. But let's go to verse 15. God says to Ezekiel, well, this will be 15 through 27, which is really the end of the chapter. Let's just read the rest of the chapter and then comment on a few things. The word of the Lord came to me, son of man, behold, I am about to take the delight of your eyes away from you at a stroke. In other words, very suddenly. You shall not mourn or weep, nor shall your tears run down. Sigh, but not aloud. In other words, keep it to yourself. Make no mourning for the dead. Bind on your turban and put your shoes on your feet. Do not cover your lips, nor eat the bread of men. So I spoke to the people in the morning, and at evening my wife died. And on the next morning, I did as I was commanded. And the people said to me, will you not tell us what these things mean for us, that you are acting thus? You know, why are you acting this way? Because obviously they would have known that his wife had died. Then I said to them, the word of the Lord came to me, say to the house of Israel, thus says the Lord God, behold, I will profane my sanctuary, the pride of your power, the delight of your eyes, and the yearning of your soul. And your sons and your daughters, whom you left behind, shall fall by the sword. And you shall do as I have done. You shall not cover your lips, nor eat the bread of men. Your turbans shall be on your heads, and your shoes on your feet. You shall not mourn or weep, but you shall rot away in your iniquities and groan to one another. Thus shall Ezekiel be to you a sign. According to all that he has done, you shall do. When this comes, then you will know that I am the Lord God. Verse 25, as for you, son of man, surely on the day when I take from them their stronghold, their joy and glory, the delight of their eyes and their soul's desire, and also their sons and daughters, on that day, a fugitive will come to you to report to you the news. On that day, your mouth will be open to the fugitive, and you shall speak and be no longer mute. So you shall be a sign to them, and they will know that I am the Lord. That's the end of chapter 24. Now, again, the gist of this is that Ezekiel is told by God, I'm going to take your wife, and you're not to visibly or audibly mourn in the customary manner. Now, as far as the mourning customs, Taylor has a nice summary here. I'll just read this little section to you. He says, the mourning customs reflected in these verses are interesting. Five aspects may be observed. A, sigh but not aloud. The word sigh is normally used of the noisy groaning of wounded men and is a reminder of the ritual lamentations that were regularly laid on for funeral occasions. And Taylor actually references the New Testament here, Mark 5:38, you know, your sort of official mourners and wailers. Second, letter B, bind on your turban. In mourning, the turban, the normal headdress of the priest, and he gives the reference Exodus 39:28, also Ezekiel 44:18. This is the normal headdress of the priest, though it was also the festal headgear for a layperson, Isaiah 61:3 and 10. Normally, it would be removed and the head covered in dust and ashes. Joshua 7:6, 1 Samuel 4:12, Job 2:12. So I'll just stop here. So the point is that when God says, keep the turban on your head, he's saying, don't do the expected mourning things, to take it off and, you know, cover your head with dust and ashes. That's a public gesture of mourning. And God says to Ezekiel, don't do that. Third, letter C in Taylor's quote, put your shoes on your feet. The sandals were taken off in time of distress, as in 2 Samuel 15:30, and also Isaiah 20, verse 2. So again, don't do that. Someone might associate that with public mourning. And again, this is me now. You know, God's whole point is that I want you to act in ways that are noticeably contrary to anything associated with public mourning. So don't you know, take the sandals off your feet, the shoes off your feet. Fourth, letter D in Taylor's quote, covering the lips was compulsory for the leper, Leviticus 13:45, and was a sign of disgrace, Micah 3:7. It involved veiling the lower part of the face from the nose downward. The lips, in Hebrew, sapam, really means mustache, or again, that part of the beard, which it regularly represents in modern Hebrew. So again, this was for the man, you would normally your face isn't veiled, but when you're mourning, again, this is something you do, and God's instructions are don't do that. Lastly, number five, the phrase, eat not the bread of men. The phrase of men, says Taylor, means ordinary or common, according to its use in Deuteronomy 3:11, Isaiah 8:1, passages like that. So the command here is not to eat ordinary food. In other words, the mourner's funeral meal. He gives another cross reference here, Jeremiah 16:7. Indeed, it is useful to compare these words with the whole section in Jeremiah 16, verses 5 through 13, where Jeremiah was forbidden by God to enter the house of mourning and was called upon to give his reasons when he was challenged by the people. So we get a similar section in Jeremiah. So when he says, you know, don't eat the food of men, it's, you know, don't eat what's typically eaten as part of a funeral meal, and as part of mourning. Don't do anything that could be construed as the normal process of mourning, because, you know, in the wake of a death. So that's what the Ezekiel's commanded. Now why? You know, the captives in Babylon, obviously, you know, who are hearing this from Ezekiel, they say, well, why? You know, verse 19, will you not tell us what these things mean for us? Why are you acting this way? And Ezekiel gives his response, you know, well, the word of the Lord came to me. You know, God gives him his response, and his response is, you know, through the words God gives to him, say to the house of Israel, thus says the Lord God, behold, I will profane my sanctuary, the pride of your power, the delight of your eyes, the yearning of your soul, and your sons and your daughters whom you left behind will fall by the sword. And when that happens, again, to condense it, when that happens, you're gonna do just what Ezekiel's been doing. That's what I want you to do. I want you to behave in your loss, the way he's behaving in his loss, because I told him so. And again, that's going to be a sign to you, you know, of this is my loss too. But I don't want, you know, I want it to be the aberration that it is, you know, that it, you know, this should have never happened. That Taylor writes here, just as Ezekiel's dearest one had been taken away from him by a single stroke, so the nation was to lose its dearest object. Its proud boast, you know, the pride of its power, the desire of its soul. Again, it's going to lose Jerusalem. The people of Jerusalem will lose Jerusalem. They'll lose the temple, and they'll lose their loved ones that are back there. Again, just like Ezekiel loses his loved one, the thing that's dearest to him, God says, I'm going to profane my own sanctuary, because this is the thing that I gave you that, you know, was obviously at one point dearest to me and was dearest to you, because what does the sanctuary indicate? My presence, the presence of the true God on earth among people, his people, the people he had chosen. That's all going away. And again, we've seen this kind of language from God before where God essentially says, you know what, I'm doing this and I'm good with it. You know, it needs to be done. So I'm not going to be upset. And as a sign to you that I'm not going to be upset, I'm telling Ezekiel when his wife dies to not mourn publicly. And that's what I want. That's how I want you to respond. That's how you should respond. And again, to illustrate both to yourselves and to the rest of the people around you, the whole group there, this is going to be a sign for how, you know, I look at things. And if you agree with me on the necessity, you know, of all this, on the rightness of it, that the fact that you deserve it, this should be the way you act too. But it, you know, God knows obviously how they look at Jerusalem and the temple and whatnot, which is again why he uses this language. Then the chapter ends again with this comment about Ezekiel, where he says, on the day, you know, that, you know, on the day that this happens, a fugitive will come to you, report to you the news, then your mouth is going to be open. Again, this is the real place where you see most clearly the transition, because back in chapter 3, Ezekiel 3 verses 25, 26 or so, Ezekiel had been struck dumb. He could only speak when God gave him a message. He couldn't function normally otherwise. But when, you know, that was done to him so that the people, if you remember, so that the people would know that when Ezekiel does speak, they need to pay attention, because the only way he can speak is when God is giving him a message. So when Ezekiel's mouth, his tongue is loosed, the people, again, who know the circumstance, should, you know, have their ears perked up, because this is a message from God. If it wasn't from God, Ezekiel wouldn't be talking, because he can't talk unless God is the one speaking through him. So that was done to get them to pay attention and to sort of discern the seriousness, the reality of what's going to happen. And then finally, you know, here we are, chapter 24. Finally, when it does happen, then the fact that Ezekiel is no longer sort of under this burden or under this restriction, that is going to be a sign that, okay, it's done now. You know, it's happened now. And it forms again this transition. So from chapter 25 onward, the subject matter of the book is going to change. And what Ezekiel says is going to change. There's no need for more prophecies of doom against the city because the city is destroyed. And the last wave of captivity, you know, is going to be occurring. Okay. It's over. It's done. Ezekiel's role is going to become more pastoral and sort of, you know, he's a prophet, but it's sort of less of a prophet, you know, the doom and gloomer. And he's going to be more pastoral. He will become he'll be referred to it with terms like shepherd and watchman. For his people, he'll start talking about the judgment of Jerusalem's enemies, not Jerusalem, but Jerusalem's enemies, who are God's enemies. He'll start talking about the positive future for Israel, that it's not completely dead. Again, going back to this remnant thinking, that God had to wipe the slate clean, but that doesn't mean that he's abandoning the plan. So again, he'll start hearing about Israel's future, even though, you know, we've had all this disaster. So the transition to a positive message for Israel only happens when the judgment actually occurs, again, in real time, and when the captives, Ezekiel himself among them, actually hears confirmation, historical confirmation from this fugitive. And that's why in the next several episodes, and if you actually look at the book, if you remember when we overviewed the book way back at the beginning, from 25 onward, there's a section, okay, from right around chapter 25 to chapter 33 or so, 32, something like that, 32, 33. That section is called the Oracles Against the Nations. So Ezekiel turns his focus, God turns his focus away from Jerusalem. We're done with that now. We'll come back to them. They will have a future. But I'll tell you who's not going to have a future. And that's my enemies. Okay, we've judged my people. We've judged Israel. Now we're going to judge. We're going to start talking about the enemies, and their judgment is going to have a finality to it that the other doesn't. Because we're going to take care of them, and then we're going to start talking about the future. And the future is not going to include them in the sense that they're going to be important empires and important city, you know, and all that kind of stuff. Whenever they're going to be mentioned, it's with this talk of they're going to be turned to Yahweh. You know, not so much in Ezekiel's book, but in other prophets, you get the same kind of thing. Jeremiah, you have oracles against the nations. And then you have talk about how they're going to bow the knee, the whole every knee shall bow kind of thing going on. That when God's enemies are spoken of in futuristic terms, it's, you know, you really get two things. You get, oh, yeah, when I judge them, that'll be it for them. And that you know, was it for them. We're done with that. And they're not going to ever return to be the entities that they were. Or it's, there's going to come out of them those who will bow the knee to the God of Israel and who will be assimilated into the family of God, into the believing community, because their hearts will be changed. You know, they, again, this whole conversion talk that we get, we're going to get some of that in Ezekiel. You get it in other prophets, but here's the transition point. So in the next few episodes, we're going to get the oracles against the nations. And so you know what the context is and why the transition is here, why the whole tone, at least the object of what Ezekiel's after, why that's going to change. So again, that's a little bit of a preview for where we're going to be in the next few episodes.
All right, Michael, I'm looking forward to that. And real quickly, Mike, I just want to remind everybody that we're still having a contest going on till the end of this month, January 31st. So please post anything you want to, encouraging people to listen to this podcast on social media. So wherever you roam, if you want to write a blog post or you want to tweet about it on Twitter or do a post on Facebook, it doesn't matter. I will find you picking three winners for Mike's new upcoming book.
I'll find you.
I will find you. We've gotten several funny posts and good posts. I certainly appreciate everybody that has done that so far. And also, Mike, we've gotten a good response on our Christmas episode. So that's pretty cool. It's a new year. So I just want to briefly mention that if our listeners out there, if you're listening to this podcast right now, if everybody, Mike, would give at least $3 a month, we would completely meet our goal of a full-time ministry. So if you're listening to this show, and every human being listening to this show right now, if you listen to it, if you just gave $3 a month, we would be able to do this ministry full-time. And that's our goal. So hopefully going in here to 2017, we'll inch closer to that goal. We completely thank you to everybody thus far, because you know, we've got the translations. We couldn't do what we're doing now without the current support.
Now that you mentioned it, I'm not going to mention anything here, because if you want specific updates on some of the projects that we're doing, translations of Supernatural is the big one for 2017. I do have a pretty significant update, but I'm only going to put that in the newsletter. So please go to drmsh.com, subscribe to the newsletter, and you'll get, you know, some specific updates on that.
And let's continue to push and encourage the people around us, whether it be at church or friends or family, expose them to this content and the show and Mike's books, and see if we can't change some minds, hearts, and thoughts out there. So, all right, Mike, well, is there anything else you'd like to add to this particular episode?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the goal here is pretty simple. We just want you to learn something. Every episode, we want you to learn something. We're trying to be a source of content, but we do need, you know, to do more of it, to do a lot more of it. Like Trey said, you know, we just need the support.
And thank you for everybody who has left a review or rated us and has left a review for Mike's books on Amazon or wherever. I also created a Naked Bible Podcast Facebook page. So if you want to do a Facebook search for the Naked Bible Podcast page, going to contemplate on what we're going to do with that. But I've created it. So if you want a safer place to go and discuss episodes amongst yourselves, you can certainly do that. I think it's the NB podcast. I think that's the handle that I had to create for Facebook, because Facebook wouldn't let me use the word naked in there. So it's a banned word, Mike. It's bad. So
there you go. Yeah. And you want to put it on t-shirt. Never mind.
Yeah. We eventually will. Well, hopefully we're going to get some swag going this year. That's one of my goals. So, we're certainly going to do that. All right, Mike. Well, we appreciate it. And, appreciate everybody else out there, and hopefully we'll have a good 2017. And I want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.